This is GabFest Radio, a weekly program about politics and culture from Slate and WNYC. On this week's Political GabFest, is President Obama's foreign policy prudent or weak? Also, the Obamacare sign-up deadline approaches. Where are the young invincibles he needs? I'm David Plotz.
And I'm Stephen Metcalf on this week's Culture GabFest. Trigger warnings, necessary empathy for the college classroom or PC on steroids. Then, is Amazon.com good for books? And then, reliving the Cold War in the FX show, The Americans.
What do you do, Stan?
I'm an FBI agent.
Wow, what do you, catch bank robbers and stuff?
Actually, I work in counterintelligence now.
Counterintelligence? That's against spies, right?
Exactly.
Have to make sure I don't do any spying around here.
Oh, you better not.
We'll start with the Political GabFest right after the news.
Hello and welcome to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. I'm David Plotz in Washington. Russia annexed Crimea this week after the region voted overwhelmingly to break from Ukraine. The Obama administration's low-key response has irritated critics from every possible direction, and he's being compared to Jimmy Carter. Is Obama's foreign policy prudent or weak? Then, Obamacare has signed up 5 million Americans, but many fewer young people than the administration had hoped for. Are the missing young invincibles a looming disaster or not really that big a deal? Joining me in Slate's D.C. studio is Slate's chief political correspondent, John Dickerson. Hello, John.
Hello, David.
And sitting in for the vacationing Emily Bazelon is Megan McArdle, a columnist for Bloomberg View. Hi, Megan.
Hello, David.
Russia annexed Crimea this week following an overwhelming vote for secession by the breakaway Ukrainian region. Russia also took over Ukrainian military facilities in Crimea, which Ukrainian soldiers did not try to block. The U.S. and Europe have responded cautiously, I would say would be the word, to the annexation, the U.S. imposing some sanctions on certain top Russians and generally muttering about the badness of what Russia is doing. And Russia came right back and sanctioned John Boehner. No, John Boehner can no longer travel to Russia, as can a bunch of other senators have been also banned.
McCain was also banned.
McCain.
He couldn't be happier. So Senator McCain said, I guess this means my spring break in Siberia is off, my Gazprom stock is lost, and my secret bank account in Moscow is frozen.
So there are complaints from various corners of Washington and elsewhere that the loss of Crimea, the chaos in Syria, the appeasement of Tehran, it's all of a piece. It's all because of President Obama's incredibly weak foreign policy. The Chinese also are eating our lunch in the South China Sea. Jimmy Carter is invoked. John Dickerson, you were saying there are people who are now looking back fondly to the days of George W. Bush. So, John, start by just outlining what are the various groups criticizing the president, and what are their basic beefs against him?
Well, you know, so you outlined the basic beef. The basic beef in its bluntest form is weakness incited this behavior. And you can say either it was Russia that reacted when the president was weak in Syria. You could say that the Iranians are taking lessons from the president's fishtailing on Syria policy. You can say that the Syrians took a lesson from Egypt when we said that if it's a military coup, we'll withdraw our support from Egypt, and then we just defined it not as a military coup. That this president's reluctance, despite what he did in Afghanistan, despite Osama bin Laden, that his clear reluctance to get engaged in a military fashion other than through drones and through those kinds of attacks has called in all of this behavior. And that's the bluntest form. And what I'm curious about is where specifically the criticisms are about things that he could have done or should do that represent a real policy distinction and difference. There's a lot of talk about weak and strong, but then they sort of stop there, and nobody gets more specific. What's interesting even about the bluntest form of this argument is that for a long time you had this, you know, president was essentially elected as a reaction to President Bush. And the question is whether this moment of flux actually means anything about a new conversation, a new national security conversation that doesn't share so much of the hangover from the Bush years. And then I'd say finally that you see not just the debate about Republicans versus the president, but you also see a conversation going on within conservative circles between somebody like, say, Rand Paul and somebody like Ted Cruz. They're fighting, although at the end of the day, again, at a policy level, I want to know specifically the thing that Ted Cruz would do that Rand Paul is against and vice versa, to come up with some kind of distinction between the two. Because, again, I think it actually – people get put in these categories, but I'm not sure with the specificity of how they distinguish themselves on these specific countries.
Well, Megan, let's give you a crack at that. So there's been a lot of sort of Monday morning quarterbacking of, oh, President Obama should have done this in the past. But looking at the current world situation, when you look at the critics of the president, do you see – real distinctions between what is being proposed by people on the right or left or the libertarian right, the neocon right, and what the president himself proposes to do? Or is it all retrospective criticism?
I think most of it, what I see at least, is retrospective criticism, is if Obama had not projected so much weakness, then now Russia would have been afraid to do this. And I think going forward, you know, realistically, who has a plan that's like, we should nuke Russia over this, or we should send troops there? No one really, right? No one is out there saying, hey, why don't we start a war with NATO, right? Bring them in. And it's kind of like the narcissistic teenage boy view of geopolitics, where like everything that happens is somehow happening in relationship to me, rather than other countries have their own agendas and they might do things that have nothing to do with us. You know, Vladimir Putin has a lot of reasons that he would like to reestablish the old Russian Empire. And in fact, everyone seems to forget that under George Bush, he went in and started taking parts of Georgia, right? It wasn't like just randomly invading other countries, had some sort of prophylactic effect where now Russia is too afraid to, we were backing Georgia and they went in and took it anyway. And we didn't do anything because in fact, it didn't make a lot of sense to start a major conflict with a nuclear power over a very small area basically in their sphere of influence.
So do you think that the claims, oh, President Obama was projecting weakness, is there anything to that claim, or is that just rhetoric that people use because it's politically expedient?
Is he projecting, in some sense, less willingness to go abroad and invade other countries than George Bush did? I mean, George Bush projected a lot of willingness. But I think then the question is, how much did that matter in this situation? And looking at what happened under Bush, I have to say, I don't think it made that much difference. It probably makes more difference in the Middle East, where it's considerably more plausible that we might actually go invade than it does in somewhere where we would be going in head to head against the world's other major nuclear power.
Right. So, John, there's the Syria part of it, which is that the president was going to strike and didn't strike because the Russians came in and sort of said, oh, yeah, we'll take the chem weapons away.
I mean, there are a couple of things that it's hard to weigh here. So we, on the domestic front, we overvalue the power of words in what a president says or doesn't say. We think it can do all kinds of magical things. So the inclination, in my view, is often to just sort of feel that way about foreign policy. I think over the years, though, you, in talking to diplomats, there is a sense in which what the American president says does matter. And the way in which people do push the envelope or not, or feel a sense of security. If the Saudis feel secure, they're not going to start making noises about wanting their own nuclear weapon. If the Israelis feel secure and that the U.S. has their back, they may not do things that cause heartburn with respect to Iran if we're trying to work out our own little side deal with Iran. The signals that they get from what a president says publicly, sometimes, you know, they go too far. When the president used the word crusade once in the context of Iraq, it haunted him for years, and the idea that he was on a religious crusade to destroy Islam. So with that long preamble, the president's muddled, fuzzy, confusing, fishtailing, to use the word again, approach to Syria does, I think, have consequences. The question is, how big are those consequences? So we know it's a failure. The question is, how much do those mistakes really affect what's happening right now? And then I think the final thing about foreign policy that always causes me difficulty in reading about this, people say, well, this is what Teddy Roosevelt did, and this is what Reagan did. And we know a lot of what they did because history has passed, and we know what they were doing behind the scenes. We really have no sense of what is going on behind the scenes here, for good or ill. We know during some of the demonstrations in Iran, the president got a lot of grief for not doing enough to push Iran. We've now subsequently found out that he was backing all kinds of covert operations to destroy their computer operations, to perhaps tacitly support the killing of their nuclear scientists. So there's a lot of stuff he was doing to try and change the dynamic in Iran that he couldn't talk about publicly. That missing piece of it, too, I think makes it hard to evaluate what's going on.
Megan, you're going to represent the libertarian wing of the Republican Party for the purposes of this discussion because you're the closest we've got. This is a new group. This is not a group that's had any SWAT within American foreign policy for a generation. I cannot, for the life of me, figure out what it is that the Rand Paul – and whoever goes with Rand Paul what they want. Is it isolationism or is it not isolationism? And is it, because it seems to me like you can't really be, if you're a Republican, you can't be for a kind of weak national defense. That's not allowed. Maybe they're for a weak national defense. I don't know.
I think they are. I mean, they are certainly substantially weaker than we have, substantially less intervention abroad. And I think that there's a couple of reasons that this has emerged. And the first is just that during the Cold War, libertarians opposed communism for fairly obvious reasons. And so they were held within this fairly hawkish coalition because at the time there really was this global war against a power that maybe not so much in the 80s, but certainly in the 50s and 60s was actually actively trying to undermine capitalist societies and so forth. And the second thing is that at this point, it really is a question of where are you going to take money from to keep the government from growing another 10% of GDP. And I think a lot of Republicans are just looking at this and saying, well, we're not going to get Social Security, but we probably could get something on defense. And I think that was where you saw Democrats made this huge strategic mistake. And I did call this one at the time. I don't always cut, but I said this. They were figuring that if with the sequester cuts, oh, Republicans will just be too afraid. Right. They won't let this happen. Right. And I said, no, they're like, you could feel it when you talk to Republicans is that they were ready. If it was that or go after Medicare, they were just going to let the defense cuts happen.
Right. Right. And your point about communism is a good one because I think there is this strain. I mean, some neocons who explicitly want it, but then just a sentimentality like, oh, remember the good old days of the Cold War. And like, wouldn't it be nice, clarifying, to have a nice moral enemy? And Putin is clearly a monster and his Russia is a terrible country. But there, we are not engaged in a grand ideological battle with Russia. Russia is a kind of regional, an unpleasant regional empire, but it is not threatened global order. We're not dividing the world up. So I don't think anyone feels like for the sake of national security, we have to contain the Russian bear.
If we don't stop it at the Crimea, they're going to be pouring through the Fulda Gap and we'll all be speaking Russia and lining up for bread within months.
How are our battle tanks?
I think
John, what is the state of America's battle tanks?
Yeah, it's they're poised.
The M1 Abrams.
I think we need more Wolverines, don't we? I mean, if we get here, we're going to...
Yeah. Everybody needs to arm themselves.
I saw Nicaraguan paratroopers outside our door the other day.
You know, I think as this conversation is now busted open, again, as unclear as it is, I think the president bears some of the responsibility for the grief he's taking because both when he came to office and then even when he was in office, there was a certain sort of smug self-satisfaction about his ability to kind of remove all the wrinkles from the rug in the world because he wasn't the kind of dumb, no foreign trips before running for president kind of binary fellow that George Bush was. And there was this sense that a man of the world who had lived other places and who'd, you know, taken those one or two trips with Dick Lugar was going to have a kind of special sort of silver surfer ride through all the difficulties in the world. And he faces now the complexities. And so the question is, if you look at the polling, Hillary Clinton does better on the questions of strength and world leader than this president now does. So how does she or somebody else running, what like posture do they take when they come in? And are we basically going to have a discussion about foreign policy that's all about posture? Because in the end, I've said this before, but when Rand Paul and Ted Cruz have a fight about what to do in Crimea, they actually both believe essentially the exact same thing. But because Ted Cruz needs to make a distinction, he talks about Rand Paul's lack of, you know, his isolationism, even though they have no substantive disagreement on the actual underlying policy.
Coming up, where are the young invincibles and why aren't they signing up for Obamacare? You're listening to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is GabFest Radio. I'm David Plotz along with Megan McArdle and John Dickerson, and this is the political GabFest portion of the show. Let's move on to our next topic. March 31st is the Obamacare sign-up deadline. If you haven't registered, you may be subject to penalties. So if you've registered, congratulations. You are one of about 4.5 million Americans who've signed up so far.
Actually, just 5 million.
Yeah, 5 million?
They just said 5 million like 2 days ago.
Oh, yeah. 5 million. And there are millions of others through the Medicaid expansion, right? I was trying to get the number. No.
That includes
the Medicaid expansion?
Right?
No.
There are millions of others.
So it's complicated because this isn't new people. Like the Medicaid number includes people who are just renewing Medicaid coverage they already had or people who were previously eligible and just decided to apply. I mean, they get more than a million churn every month just naturally before Obamacare. And it's also not clear how many of those people, first of all, how many of the 5 million have paid? And then second of all, how many of them had insurance before? We think that a lot of the people who signed up before December are probably people who had insurance, either had their policies canceled or were just looking to get a subsidy because they're now eligible for one, and that most of those people were we don't really know, but we think that most of those people already had insurance. The people signing up now are more likely to be uninsured. It's going to take a long time to sort this out. I think the best number we have is that if you look at the Gallup poll on the uninsured, there's been a decline in the number of the uninsured. There was originally a decline from 18% to 16%, but that 18% looks like it was an outlier. It had never been that high before. It was just one quarter, and the others, each quarter on either side of it was 17.1. So if we assume that 17.1 is about the right number, looks like about 1.1% of the population, which would be 3 to 3.5 million people, have gained insurance as a result of
Obamacare. So that's the delta.
That would be, yeah, that is my best guess at the delta.
And so some of the people who would have signed up for Obamacare are people who were on individual plans
and
moving to an Obamacare plan, or people who maybe don't like their employers. Well, no, if you're on your employer's plan, you're kind of stuck with it.
No, it's complicated. Now, if your employer's plan costs you more than 10.5% of your income, then you can switch to Obamacare and be eligible for subsidies. So, this whole thing is really the decision tree looks like one of those, like, 9,000-year-old redwoods with 80 million branches.
So, Megan, you wrote a column for Bloomberg View this week about the relative elderliness of the population that has signed up for the exchanges. The Obamacare initial desires were for about 40%.
Yes, 38.5%. 38.5,
they wanted 38.5 to be under 35?
Over 18 and under 35.
Okay.
Because that's the group that basically uses no health care. So you take premiums from them every month. They don't use health care. And that basically, with the way that Obamacare is set up, that subsidizes the policies for everyone else.
And in fact, the percentage of 18 to 35-year-olds who in the exchanges are what now?
It's right as of the end of February, it was 25%, which had been the worst case scenario that people had been talking about as like, well, we know this isn't going to happen, but just, look, this is how bad it could get, but it's not going to get that bad.
I know nothing about the insurance industry. I would have thought that if the numbers were catastrophic, we would hear more panic from the insurers, that they would be freaking out because they're the ones who are going to be paying out to all these insured people, these sick, elderly, non-18 to 35-year-old insured people. Is there such panic in the offing?
Well, not exactly, because the government has all these risk corridors.
Because they're all in LexisLink.
Basically, if the losses are big, the government will eat about 80% of the losses. So that's pretty large. Although the government now says this is budget neutral, but has not released any mechanism that would make this budget neutral. The Hill had a piece yesterday that basically said that in some areas, premiums may triple on the exchanges and that insurers are actually freaking out and don't know why the administration is saying that premiums are going to be low. That said, of course, they're engaged in a lengthy negotiation with the administration to get more goodies, mm-hmm. right? They want more risk corridor. They want rules that are friendlier to them and in various other ways basically have government payments funneled to them in order to offset all these losses. And so right now they're engaged in this kind of kabuki theater where you say, I'm in a populist swing state, insurance premiums are going to triple. Wouldn't you like to make the risk corridors a little more generous, Mr. President? So it's not clear, to me at least, how much of this is strategic and how much of this is their actual plans.
That's right. And one other thing I would add is just in talking to somebody who worked in the industry, they say, as much of a pain in the ass as this has been and as much as we've been clashing with the administration, we still do want all these policies.
Right.
So they want all – the whole reason they were behind it in the first place is it means lots and lots of new people coming in to sign up. So they do still want those people to sign up, and so they're not going to do – now, we may hear something quite different after the March 31st deadline.
So the president has been making these slightly desperate, it's like a guy who's dating a woman who's too young for him kind of moves, the Between Two Ferns appearance. And then he gave an interview to WebMD. He will not give an interview to the New York Times, but he gives an interview to WebMD in this attempt.
And
I guess young people.
Well, I think WebMD probably asked him fewer hard questions than the New York Times would.
And Ellen. He goes on Ellen. It's this way of attempting to reach the 18 to 35-year-olds. Do you guys think it works? It has an effect? The Between Two Ferns appearance clearly increased traffic to the healthcare.gov website. But also, is it seemly for him to be doing this?
I was actually shocked they got their biggest traffic day ever after a Funnier Die video on Obamacare went viral. I mean, so I guess it works. I don't, if it were me, I probably wouldn't try to reach, I don't know what the kids these days do with their Snapchatting and whatever it is, but I probably wouldn't have chosen Ellen as like my vehicle to try to reach the young folk. You understand why the president wants to go and sell his major policy achievement. I do wonder if he isn't getting a little overexposed with all the quasi-hip things where it actually then becomes a joke and backfires.
What do you guys make of the Republican gestures towards a plan? They haven't actually clarified into anything that is remotely like a plan or a bill. It's sort of like the phasers, whatever they threw up a few weeks ago about immigration, where they were like, oh, we're going to have these immigration ideas, but they never came to anything. I mean, do you think that the Republicans are actually going to clarify around a set of principles even like a bill?
If they have the House and Senate, I mean, next year after the elections.
But do you think there's an agreement about principles that they could get to?
Well, there's agreement of principles, but then there's agreement about principles on immigration, too. But I think the next step, that'll be fascinating. I mean, because if they take control of the Senate, which there's probably now a little bit more of slightly more than a 50% chance that they'll do that, then you really do have to do something. You have to put something into legislative language. And that, I think, will be a complex and really interesting discussion and fight.
Are you impressed by what you've heard about it, Megan?
They're still debating, right? Like, there's still a big debate within the Republican Party about how to approach this, whether to approach it, what specific things you want to try to do. Paul Ryan came out with premium support that went down like a lead balloon. I think they're still talking. And fundamentally, it's a hard conversation. The reason Obamacare is so messed up, right, is that the zone of politically possible things you can do in the healthcare space is very small and none of them make any sense. So, I have to do a plan that's cheap and doesn't take anything away that anyone already has. Like, that's not, and also doesn't offend any of the providers. Well, that's not really realistic. And Republicans are running into the same problem Democrats had. Democrats had a kind of zealots, like, we're going over the hill, guys, and if half of you die, that's too bad, but we're going to take that hill. And Republicans don't feel that way. So I really don't know where it's going to end up.
That'll do it for the Political Gabfest portion of the show. You'll find a longer version of the show with more topics at slate.com/podcasts. I'm David Plotz in Washington. The Culture Gabfest starts right now.
This is Gabfest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Slate Culture Gabfest, The Americans. It's a show on FX about deep cover Soviet spies, and it's excellent. And then we discuss Amazon.com. Will it destroy literature as we've come to know it since the Gutenberg Revolution? And finally, trigger warnings. Are they the latest frontier in empathy, or are they PC on steroids? Joining me today is Slate's deputy editor, Julia Turner. Hey, Julia.
Hi, Steve.
And, of course, Dana Stevens, Slate's film critic. Dana, hi.
Hey, Steve.
All right. Well, let's dig right in. The Americans is an FX TV show. It's entering its second season. It stars Kerry Russell and Matthew Rhys as a married couple who, in America, in Washington, D.C., in the Washington, D.C. area, who are in actuality, deep cover Soviet spies. They've been embedded in the United States for something like 15 years when the show opens. It's a period piece. Takes place in the early Reagan years, and they've completely normalized themselves as American citizens. They're raising children who, of course, are completely in the dark as to their true identities. And in the middle of the marriage is a schism opening up between the father, who's beginning to like living in a capitalist and open society, and the wife, played by Kerry Russell, quite well by Kerry Russell, who's still committed to defending her motherland. This is what I pick up from having watched only the pilot of the show, and I defend myself for having only watched the pilot of the show, because once I watched it, Julia Turner, I was completely, utterly crushed out on this. I think it is terrific television, and I don't want it spoiled. So you are going to have to step gingerly around my ignorance. But tell me, you're caught up to, you're contemporaneous with the show in its run. Am I right to be this swoony for it?
I think this is a very strong and interesting show, which, as far as I've watched in the second season, seems to only be getting stronger. We should acknowledge here that it's created by Joe Weisberg, who is the brother of Jacob Weisberg, the chairman of the Slate Group. But I've never met Joe Weisberg, and I think my view of the show is independent of that fact. The thing I like best about it is that it is simultaneously a show about politics and about marriage. And instead of having kind of soap opera relations among the characters that allow for a lot of spy hijinks with crazy wigs and dark alleys and getaways and car chases, the show uses crazy wigs and getaways and car chases as a way of talking about marriage. I mean, to me, the 80s backdrop and the Cold War backdrop end up being just an amazing lens through which to view the strange relationship between these two people and, you know, the fundamental alienness of turning two lives into one life, which is what the, you know, project of marriage is.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Dana, before we get to your valued opinion, why don't we listen to a clip from the show?
Do you know where your father is?
He's upstairs.
Well, do we have visitors already?
Yeah, this is Stan.
Hey.
Phil Jennings.
How you doing, Stan Beeman?
My wife, Elizabeth Page.
Hi.
Henry.
Hi.
Hi. Hey, Henry.
Hello.
Are those brownies?
Homemade.
Matt? Mm. Your mom's a good cook?
Okay. Yes.
Okay.
I should have taken
them. No.
Mm.
Thank you.
Oh, that's a good brownie, huh?
Yeah.
So this is a pretty good neighborhood we moved into, huh?
Wouldn't live anywhere else. You know, safe, clean, commute to D.C. is not too bad. Do you work in the city?
I do.
What do you do, Stan?
I'm an FBI agent.
FBI? Wow. What do you catch bank robbers and stuff?
Actually, I work in counterintelligence now.
That's against spies, right?
Exactly.
Ooh. Have to make sure I don't do any spying around here.
Oh, you better not. Especially for those Russians.
Oh, yeah. They're the worst, right?
Oh, they certainly are, Philip. They certainly are.
I have been enlightened by Julia Turner as to one reason I love the show, which is that there is something fundamentally strange about constantly taking on a second self in the act of marriage, right? That you're achieving some ultimate intimacy, but you're also occasionally bumping up against its limits and therefore coming up against a kind of ultimate alienation. I don't know. I'm sort of riffing now on what she said because it blew my mind. But I do think that that's why I love the show, and I'm wondering if that's why maybe you do.
Yeah, I mean, I think that gets at the originality of the show, for sure. But I think we should also not neglect the extent to which the spy hijinks are just fascinating and juicy in and of themselves. I mean, there's a lot. By the time we get to the second season, and I've watched every episode now, I'm obsessed with the show. By the time we get to the second season, there's a lot of double agent, triple agent, you know, people mutually betraying each other in, you know, mutual fake affairs. And I won't bring in all the spoilers, Steve, that you don't want to know about. But let's just say that Elizabeth and Philip, these two characters, start to have all kinds of separate lives and to be managing, you know, a lot of different balls in the air at once. And so that stuff is all really fun, too. If you watched it with no sort of metaphorical intent about, you know, marriage allegories whatsoever, you would still have a great time with this show.
One other thing that I find super enjoyable about the show is its portrayal of the 80s. As we move on in time, we're suddenly getting period renderings. The Americans gives us a Technicolor portrait of the 80s, Farrah Fawcett hair, amazing 80s bedspreads. There's a lot of material culture represented on the show in a fascinating way. Steve, I know you can't give us any hints from your tome about the 80s that you're concocting, but I'm curious, as our resident 80s expert, what you make of this show's portrait of that time.
It's the perfect time to set the show. It's a very canny choice on the part of the creator, because not only is it so intrinsically interesting to see this marriage, which is divided in this fascinating way, and these people are spies and on, it's such a beautiful setup. It's just perfectly timed for that moment when anti-communism made a resurgence within the United States. So that's perfect. And then secondly, the culture became vastly more self-consciously materialistic in the 80s, unapologetically materialistic under Reagan. So all of the things I imagine that drive the Carrie Russell character, the woman who's more faithful to communism in the motherland, all the things that drive her crazy about a capitalist society are only going to get that more intense as the show goes along. So I think it's just a great choice, and so far so good.
One thing that I'm intrigued about in season two, and that I think speaks to the show's ambitions, is that they're really bringing the children to the fore in a fundamental way. These two have entered into a false marriage and born two American children who are at root cover. They exist as cover for spies. Like, their genesis into the world is not because two loving people created baby humans. And these, you know, ultimate cover creatures are growing up into teenagers who are beginning to have questions about their parents' weird moments of urgent insistence and strange doings in the laundry room. And I think in the same way that spycraft became a metaphor for marriage in season one, I think season two is beginning to play with the fundamental alienation between parents and children. So that fundamental tension is getting played with in a super fascinating way.
Oh, it's so, I agree with you totally, Julie. It's so ripe. I mean, it was exploited beautifully in The Sopranos. I mean, I remember in one of the very early episodes of season one of The Sopranos, the daughter's name is Meadow, I believe, takes the junior aside and says, you know what our father does, and he's complete classic younger sibling. He's completely in the dark. And that was just done so beautifully. Meadow clearly is an Ivy League mind and temperament, and Junior is kind of a gaudy junior type who probably doesn't have much of a, you know, capacity for life outside of what his father has done and may not have much capacity within it. That was just done so beautifully. It's set up exactly the same way in this show, Dana. I mean, what is going to happen to these kids? On what premise are they going to make their own lives? I mean, it's just, it's so beautifully teed up. I really think it's intriguing.
Well, you'll see in the second season, Steve, that the kids come much more into play in the spy plot as well and start to come under threat. And that's also interesting in that it tests the Carrie Russell, Elizabeth character's relationship to her children. Because as you mentioned earlier, she is, you know, pretty much an ice cold ideological devotee to the motherland, right? Much more so than her husband, who is starting to enjoy the creature comforts of living in the U.S. And so there's something of a question as to what her children mean to her in the first season, right? Because she's just so single-minded and monomaniacal about spying. And so in the second season, when they start to come under pressure, it's also a great revelation about her character. I love that Carrie Russell character, even though the show does function on the absolutely absurd assumption that the 98-pound Carrie Russell can essentially best any opponent in a fight.
All right. Well, we like it. It's called The Americans. It's on FX. It's entering its second season. It is starting. You heard it here first. It's starting to get that kind of buzzy buzz that I remember Breaking Bad starting to get in its second season. It might be that good. Tell us what you think. Come to our Facebook page, facebook.com/culturefest. Did we swoon too hard or not hard enough? Let us know. Coming up, will Amazon destroy literature? You're listening to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is GabFest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf, along with Dana Stevens and Julia Turner, and this is the Culture GabFest portion of the show. If you'd like to find links for things we mention on the program, we collect them for you on our show page, wnyc.org/GabFest. And please, if you would, leave a comment while you're there. Tell us what you think of us. Do you love us? Do you hate us? Somewhere in between, we don't care. Well, we care, so tell us. But that's wnyc.org/GabFest. All right, moving on. Book publishing is a very human business, and Amazon is an octopus for whom books are less the best of what's been thought and said than widgets, or maybe even worse, a Trojan horse, a means for becoming the Walmart of the ethersphere. Amazon.com has just raised the price of its Prime membership from $79 to $99. That's our excuse for talking about this. But as background, Julia, we all read George Packer's remarkable long and reported piece about Amazon. Cheap words, Amazon is good for customers, but is it good for books? Julia, I have to believe that a savvy person such as yourself is a member of Amazon Prime. Are you? And were you put out by this $20 hike?
So I am 100% a member of Amazon Prime, and Slate created a widget when the news of this price hike went up that allowed you to check how many orders you'd done in the past year to figure out whether Amazon Prime was worth it for you, whether the free shipping equaled out. I think the equilibrium number is somewhere between 25 and 35. If you've done in that range of orders, it's worth it for you to do Amazon Prime. My household, with the advent of twin babies, had done 106 orders at Amazon last year, which means I think something was arriving at our house from Amazon every 3 days all year long. So, yeah, I'm deep in Jeff Bezos's thrall. Dana, are you an Amazon Prime member?
I am not. And after reading George Packer's expose of what goes on behind the scenes at Amazon, there is no way I'm joining Prime at any price. And I think I will never order a book from Amazon again. I can't guarantee I'll never order anything because Amazon has its tentacles in every part of our consciousness. And I think I have a movie on rental from Amazon right now. But when it comes to straight up books, I'm going to Powell's Books or to my local bookstore.
All right. Mm-hmm. She was persuaded by the Packer. Steve, where does your household fall on the Primeometer?
I will not order a freshly published new book off of Amazon, no matter what. I will go to an independent bookstore and have them order it for me if they don't have it in stock, period, end of story. Therefore, I share some of Dana's Park Slope ideological rigidity, and I also have some of the supple, pragmatic expediency of a soulless person like Julia Turner.
The perfect combo.
Exactly. That's Metcalf Prime right there.
I'm curious about the George Packer piece. It sounds, Dana, like you thought it was very persuasive.
Well, I mean, it's not making any argument that I think I didn't know already, which is just that the culture of Amazon is utterly uninterested in and actually to a greater degree than I would have thought, antithetical to the business of book publishing. But some of the descriptions of chicanery and the kind of trickery that goes on with, you know, buy buttons being taken off of books because Jeff Bezos didn't like the deal that he got with a certain publisher, or some of the descriptions of the labor conditions at Amazon, which, again, have been widely reported. But just to see it all conglomerated in one place, it just gave me a very bad feeling about the company.
But Dana, don't you think that, I mean, my takeaway from the piece was that because Amazon has made books incidental to it, I can make books incidental to Amazon, that they're relatively indifferent to books, and therefore I don't need to use it for that. But there is something sinister about how they want to get into publishing. Their indifference to books actually now has been surmounted to the degree that they themselves want to become a content, quote unquote, content provider in the quote unquote book space. Language that makes one shudder.
Yeah, I mean, the George Packer piece is worth reading, I think, if you care about Amazon or are interested in it. It runs down in a clear way a number of the different debates about Amazon over the years, from how it got into the book business, its various fights with book publishing, the attempt by book publishers to work with Apple to raise the price of ebooks. I will take some issue with George Packer's tone throughout the piece. I sort of wish that someone had written a version of this piece who seemed to have less of a dog in the fight. The piece takes almost as a given that the best means of discovering talent and producing great books is the business model perpetuated by New York Book Publishing, and that any ways in which it has been prodded to change or shift in response to the rise of digital books or the rise of Amazon are an unmitigated force for bad and decline and evil and woe. And, you know, as I think our listeners know, I do not think that technology is the end of all things.
On top of which, you know, people have been writing elegies to book publishing now for 20 years. It really began, if you had to be, you know, mournful about it and nostalgic about it, you really would date it to the corporate ownership and consolidation that began in the 70s and 80s. And since then, profit margins have been under huge pressure, and editors have been under huge pressure. They're under totally different time pressures. They don't really edit that much anymore. They don't nurture talent. And furthermore, the old business model of having a gigantic backlist filled with books that have survived the decades, the Catchers in the Rye, you know, Catcher in the Rye, or, you know, name five. I mean, every publishing house has dozens of those, right? And you're all your fixed costs on that have been paid off. And they're just free cash flow by which you get to go and scout new talent. And you waste an enormous amount of money giving book advances to writers who may not go anywhere on their first, second, third, or fourth book, but maybe hit on their fifth book. I mean, the aura of sleepiness, literary care, and patience did all go together once and did create, I think, a beautiful culture of literariness and literary hope that fresh Salingers and fresh Faulkners were out there and could be nurtured and found. And it is, I do think, in some substantial way gone. But I don't know that Amazon was the principal villain in that story.
Right. And one thing that's actually fascinating about Amazon, which our former colleague Matthew Iglesias has written about smartly, is that Amazon is actually not relentlessly pursuing profit margins. Amazon relentlessly pursues pleasing consumers in the interest of getting ever more consumers. And, of course, the fear is that once they have us all under lock and key, then they will flip the switch and raise the prices and rake in gajillions of profits. But for a company that is so well regarded by Wall Street, they have been remarkably willing to have very, very small profit margins on the sheer gajillions of dollars they are raking in terms of revenue. And Matthew Iglesias argued in a long piece on their latest earnings report for us that, you know, this is fundamentally a smart move by Bezos to invest in attracting consumers by giving them what they want. My complete expectation that my every consumer need can be met by the internet if I'm, no matter how disorganized I am, if I pay my Prime membership, I'll just be able to get whatever the hell I want whenever I want it. I've become such a brat as a consumer as a result of Amazon. I want everything now. I don't want to have to plan in advance. I don't want to have to go anywhere. I don't have to leave my house. I don't want to have to get dressed. They have turned me into a monster, and I'm a very happy monster because my needs are mostly met.
Well, and this is what you keep reading industry analysts saying about this price hike, which is, after all, a 25% price hike in Prime membership that, you know, a lot of people are just going to go with it because they're too addicted to buying things online to reconsider. I mean, talk about antitrust. What Amazon is trying to do is to go way beyond being an online store and become this sort of I don't know what you would even call it. Yes, an online need meter for any conceivable need that one could have. And then by creating that loyal of a customer base, you can raise the Prime rates as high as you want.
Or prices themselves.
All right. Well, the piece, once again, is Cheap Words. Amazon is good for customers. Is it good for books? It was by George Packer in the February 17th, 2014 issue of The New Yorker. It's a great piece of journalism. Read it. And then comment and tell us what you think about book culture and whether or not you will change your habits in the face of Amazon.com's omnivorous ambitions. That's Facebook.com/CultureFest. All right, moving on. Avid readers of the internet will likely have come across the alert trigger warning, signaling that the blog post or article may contain disturbing themes that can provoke traumatic memories in the reader. Now, apparently, trigger warnings are migrating from the internet into elite colleges and the classrooms. Some professors are now offering trigger warnings at the beginning of lectures, saying things along the lines of the content of this lecture may trigger the onset of symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. Dana, I scarcely know what to make of this issue. I have taught hundreds upon hundreds of university students over the last 20, 25 years of my life. It always seemed to me that it was incumbent upon me to have internalized the sensitivities of whatever generation I was speaking to and to talk in an aware manner. However, the formalizing of it seems to push the boundary in a direction some people are uncomfortable with. Is this PC on steroids, or is this just common courtesy?
Well, you know, as I gather, the trigger warning originated in a very specific place. It originated in places like feminist blogs, you know, spaces where people were going specifically to post or to talk about experiences that they'd been through that, you know, the trigger warnings were meant to protect against. And especially, I think at the beginning, they were meant to protect against graphic content, which I can completely understand as someone who hates when I click through to a news story about a bombing or a war and see some horrible picture of a dismembered person. I mean, insofar as they might keep someone from clicking on an image that they don't want to see because it's too disturbing for them, I completely understand the origin of the trigger warning. I do wonder, though, about it starting to migrate to, as you say, syllabuses and college courses. Or there were also some complaints, I understand, about the third season of Downton Abbey, which included a rape plotline, and people thought that the show itself should have included a trigger warning before it aired. I think that starts to get into an area, I wouldn't quite call it censorship, but it does seem to be an area where freedom of speech is being impinged by the possible sensitivities of some viewers.
The smartest thing I think I've read about this, or the smartest comment I've seen on this, was a post from an editor at Jezebel responding to a very stupid post opposing to trigger warnings. Someone wrote a post saying, these are stupid, a bunch of like sensitive people should just get over their rapes already and not need trigger warnings. I mean, it was like the worst possible piece arguing that trigger warnings are stupid and useless. And there was a Jezebel post saying, this is a dumb post. It does not further the conversation. The question of whether these should be allowed is very real. It needs to be thoughtfully considered. Here at Jezebel, we've considered it and decided not to do trigger warnings because we feel that the headlines of our post should provide sufficient information for a reader to determine whether this is a post that they should avoid given their own sensitivities. And to me, that seemed so smart. The thing that bothers me about trigger warnings, when I first started seeing them on the internet, they drove me crazy. I thought it was just like it galled me when I first encountered them. I thought they were stupid. And then upon thinking about it more and recognize the context they come from, I understand a little bit more about how they could be useful to some readers in some places. But what bothers me about them, I realize, is fundamentally more editorial than functional. To me, they seem like they really don't serve much of a purpose beyond the headline, because it's impossible to know what specifically may trigger any particular person to have a horrible flashback to whatever bad experience they may have had. For one thing, the range of bad experiences that can be had by people in the world and that they may not want to reflect on is infinite. So as I thought this through, I figured out, I think that what galls me about the trigger warning is its editorial redundance, that it seems not to actually serve to help the people who it claims to be helping. Instead, it seems to serve as a signifier saying, I am the sort of person, place, journalistic entity, teacher who wants to be seen as helpful to those people. It seems more concerned with the appearance of the person purveying the information than it does in actually helping specific individuals. And that's what bothers me about it.
Yeah, I think that's beautifully put, Julia. And this dovetails with my two reactions to it. The first is that I'd use an allergy metaphor. There are some kids that are actually dangerously, lethally allergic to peanuts and various other substances, eggs, on and on and on. Then a kind of culture of sensitivity develops around that, and a lot of parents begin not exposing their kids to certain foods. And there's just somewhere along the way there's a dividing line between a medical necessity and a neurosis, all of which would be innocent if you didn't, in fact, begin to create the sensitivity in the child. That, in fact, by not exposing them to certain things, they become all but allergic to it when they are exposed. And I think that holds up as a metaphor for, you know, the way we treat young developing minds within a university context. If you're constantly telling them and reinforcing the idea that their mind is this painfully sensitive, triggerable entity, that's the kind of mind they're going to develop. And this gets to a second issue, which is, this is, to me, and this is a very idiosyncratic take on this, but I see this as a generational power struggle with the kind of quasi-pastoral authority that professors have. They're encountering young minds that have been trained principally by the mass media and their peers and would like to show up at a university and essentially tell their professors how to talk to them. And it seems to me it's just a shift that's gone on since the 60s, accelerated since the 80s, whereby the discourse of the college classroom, that the temper of it has become dictated increasingly by the quote-unquote consumer. And to me, that is totally baleful.
Yeah, I mean, I hear you, Steve. The other thing, though, I think, is we are all coming from a certain generation, or at least several generations of academia that are a bit far from the current context. And even in hearing my own critique, you know, I think some defenders of this practice would probably say conveying to your audience that you are concerned about the experience and needs of victims is in of itself a valuable thing to do. So the split that I pointed out, that it seems more like a signifier of what sort of person you want to be perceived to be versus an actual useful thing for victims, I think there are probably some people who would offer the counterargument that even saying, hey, I care about the experience of victims, I, you know, want you to know that, you should come talk to me if you have an issue, it sort of signifies an openness towards that experience that may in and of itself have value.
All right. Well, it is a complicated topic. We don't pretend to have all the answers. I will say one place to go to begin learning about it is the article that the New Republic ran on it back in their March 3rd issue. It's called Trigger Happy. The trigger warning has spread from blogs to college classes. Can it be stopped? By Jenny Jarvie. It's a good piece. Go read it and tell us what you thought of it. Facebook.com/culturefest. Okay. Now is the moment in our podcast where we endorse. What do you have?
All right. My endorsement today is going to take some courage because I have to pretend for the length of one sentence that I understand the big discovery in astronomy and physics that happened this week. You guys know what I'm talking about. The fraction
ripples.
Of the second, the beginning of the universe, the gravitational waves.
They found those ripples.
They found ripples, which prove something that happened in the fraction of a second after the universe began with the Big Bang, the inflation theory. But what I'm endorsing is not an explanation of this mysterious, inexplicable event, but rather a little clip that I found on Kottke.org, the wonderful blog this morning, of the Stanford professor Andre Lind, who's a physics professor, who came up with a theory essentially predicting this discovery around 30 years ago and, you know, has been sort of waiting for the proof to come in and maybe thinking that it never would. And there's a wonderful moment when a younger professor at Stanford knocks on his door. It's like a sweepstakes commercial or something. Knocks on the guy's door. The physics professor and his wife answer the door. She is also a physics professor. And they stand there and hear, you know, this, to me, inexplicable explanation of the fact that his theory has proven to be true. And it's just such a wonderful moment. They're speechless. They hug. They get teary. They drink champagne. They talk about what it means to them that, you know, this theory has been vindicated. And just to see these people whose minds are capable of thinking out the origin of the universe and what happened in the fraction of a second after everything began to exist and just having a champagne toast to their correctness is just, it's a beautiful thing. So anyway, Kottke.org linked to it, and we'll put a link on our show page so you can all watch and weep along.
Oh, that is so excellent. Julia, what do you have?
Well, because I am a, you know, soulless bot, I've gone in recently for the quantified self. I edited Seth Stevenson's piece for us about fitness trackers. You know about these things? They're like little pendants that you wear, and they track your steps, and they track your miles walked, and they track your sleep, and they track your pulse, and this, that, and the other. And in the wake of editing the piece, I decided that I wanted to quantify my own life. So I got the Fitbit Flex, and it's really fun. I can't imagine that either of you would like it, actually. I'm not sure if you guys see data as your friend, but maybe you would. I don't know. It syncs up with a little app in your phone, and, you know, you can see how many steps did you walk, and it, it does change your decisions. You think, oh, maybe I'll go out for lunch today instead of ordering delivery, or instead of taking two trains with a shorter walk, maybe I'll walk further and take one train home. It is a little morsel of information in my day that does affect the decisions I make and change my behavior, and it's getting me to be a little bit more active than I was in my hibernating, sedentary, take cabs all the time winter self. So I recommend fitness trackers if you think you would enjoy quantifying your own experience.
I love it. Okay, well, my endorsement is my 8-year-old daughter, who went from 7 to being 8, on her birthday demanded a karaoke party. And I have never really done karaoke before, but I discovered what the real joy of karaoke is. It's not caterwauling these songs a half a note or half an octave off key. What it is discovering your and your party guest's true karaoke self. It's all about discovering your karaoke self, because you think your karaoke self is going to be one thing, and it turns out to be something completely different. So I wanted my karaoke self to be, you know, either Paul Westerberg or Bruce Springsteen. It turns out it's John Cougar Mellencamp. But there's like growth inherent in discovering your karaoke self. Unless, of course, you can actually sing. And our lovely ex-nanny, Susanna Bortner, came up for the weekend to our house to celebrate my daughter's 8th birthday. And in addition to being many wonderful things, she's an incredible singer. And if so, of course, your karaoke self is whatever you want it to be if you're really a good singer. And for that night, her karaoke self was Petula Clark, and the song was Don't Sleep in the Subway, a song I had never heard before. I had no idea. And as she was singing it, I thought, this almost has to be a Petula Clark song. So I'm going to endorse discovering your karaoke self. And additionally, the song Don't Sleep in the Subway by Petula Clark is a great tune.
Can I say that I think, like, the greatest psychological problem in my life is that I have never discovered my karaoke self? I've, like, yet to have a karaoke experience where I really fully... I think that's like my major psychic torment.
All right, that does it. We're doing a karaoke segment. I was already thinking that during Steve's endorsement, but if Julia hasn't discovered her karaoke self, I mean, come on.
All right, well, Dana, thank you so much.
Thanks, Steve.
Julia, thanks a lot.
Thanks, guys.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about on today's program at wnyc.org/gabfest, where you can also leave a comment, and you'll find the longer podcast versions of our shows on iTunes, TuneIn, or in the WNYC iPhone app. Just search for Slate Gabfest. Gabfest Radio is a production of Slate.com, which is solely responsible for its content. The producers are Ann Hepperman and Mike Volo. Our interns are Rebecca Cohen and Anna Schechtman. The executive producer is Andy Bowers. For everyone on the Gabfest crew, I'm Stephen Metcalf, and we'll talk to you next week.
Now the reason we're here as man and woman is to love each other.